The inductance, in other words, when you're tuning it with a rotary inductor, you do have this opportunity to change the amplifier's Q. So what they basically were explaining in loading that amplifier using those tubes, decreasing the inductance and increasing the capacitance, and all lower inductance and increasing the capacitance of the tank circuit will increase the Q. Now, the amplifier then will then provide more power output over a larger frequency with a lower tank circuit Q. But harmonic suppression will also decrease, and possibilities of interference, you know, is increased. So they recommend that the overall efficiency, and how they determine that was a whole complicated thing, should be at minimum around 60%. this is basically Collins' thinking on that type of amplifier. I mean, I'm just, you know, paraphrasing it basically off the top of my head. But they said if you're going to run at different power levels, that adjusting the inductance. Now, I would say that you haven't got that, that flexibility, but that's a heavy-loaded amplifier, and basically, I would say the best thing to do is just back off on the drive stick, and because not to in any way change the inductive capacitive, relationship there because of that type of design, Dick. As Colin said, you know, they were looking for the situation to give it a lower Q tank, lower Q, but you know, but at that point you got to be careful because the harmonic suppression also decreases, Dick, over.
Yeah, I've got a bunch of opinions on this one, Mel. In the case of the Collins amplifier, you had a finite diameter of that wire that's used in your roll inductor, and it also had sliding contacts in that roll inductor. The good news about the roll inductor is you can choose the LC ratio you wanted on any particular band, as long as your capacitors didn't run out of range. And now you've got pluses and minuses for advantages and disadvantages for setting the Q of the tank circuit. As you lower the inductance and reestablish resonance by increasing the capacitance, the total amount of stored energy in your LC tank circuit, your Pi network if it's a Pi, increases. And that's one of the definitions of Q. Energy stored versus energy dissipated per cycle. The higher Q circuit is without a doubt better on harmonic suppression. That's the good news. But the circulating currents on a higher Q circuit go up higher. Therefore, the insertion loss or the dissipation of your tank circuit increases. So there's the compromise. More power loss in the tank circuit versus harmonic suppression. However, where you've got a really big chunk of copper tubing that Rich is using in his amplifier, I think the amount of watts he's dissipating in his tank circuit compared to the number of watts his tube is generating, I think his dissipation watts in his tank is small. It's only a couple of percent. If he went from 1% loss in his tank circuit to 2% loss, yeah, he's generating twice as much heat. But in power output, nobody will ever see the difference on the S-meter on the other end. The good news about a lower Q tank circuit is that the insertion loss of the tank circuit goes down, the dissipation goes down, the circulating currents go down, and it becomes a broader band amplifier. You QSY and you don't have to retune the final, so to speak, if you've got a lower Q circuit. If I was him, I would choose the low Q capability, and if I was worried about harmonics, I'd put a low-pass filter into the amplifier. And that way guarantees that he's not turning out harmonics. So the real difference in watts of dissipation of his tank circuit, whether it be high Q or low Q, and he would have all of that as a variable if he had a roll inductor, I think that's a minor improvement. I would go for a Q of 10 or 12. It doesn't have to be high. And if harmonics are there, get rid of it with a low pass filter. But the advantage of a 10 or 2, 10 or 12 Q is that you don't have to keep retuning every time you QSY. These are some of my opinions on that subject, Mel. You may have some differing opinions, so I'm going to turn it back to you for a rebuttal. K2KEY, K2RIW, expressing opinions.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, you're exactly right. That's right. The Q that Collins usually was their standard was a Q somewhere between 12 and 15. That's their standard almost in almost all their amplifiers. They always stress that they have a Q design of between 12 and 15. And going for the lower Q, you definitely, I would say, you know what to do? I think the best thing to do, I use a tuner. I use the Johnson Kilowatt Matchbox. That's my favorite tuner that I use. I got it so set up now. I've got separate transmitters. I got 25, you know, set up there. I got four linear amplifiers, so I've got this now four more or less. That I leave one, each one on the band that it's set for, and separate rigs and everything to each band. That's what I've got down to, Dick. But you do go for a lower Q, down to around 10 to 12, that's why I find that I have the tuner in the line, and I know that will give me, you know, sufficient harmonic suppression. I don't think you're going to get that much problem with harmonic, really, to begin with, but make sure, you know, just to, if you're going to have availability of course, a spectrum analyzer, I would take a look at it, but those amplifiers, they stress over and over, heavy loading, heavy loading on that amplifier. Once you heavy load it, that's where you leave it. And the only thing I would do, if you know, you want to reduce, of course, the power, is just with the drive. That's it. I wouldn't do anything, you know, try to do any trickery with the final circuits in a way of really fooling around too much with the Q. I would say if you are getting somewhere of a Q around, 10 to 12, yeah, it's in the ballpark. Why? I don't know. Collins had a lot of fancy formulation there where they showed Qs between 12 and 15, which they are usually looking for on almost all their designs. I noticed that over and over. That was mentioned, Dick, over.
Yeah, and I think what you're doing with your big, fancy tuner you described to us in the past, which have got some very stoochy components in there, my guess is your antenna tuner is not necessarily being used as a balancing device, although it is when you feed your loop antenna that's outdoors up in the air, or I don't think you're using it as a impedance matcher. My guess is even if you had a 50 ohm antenna, you would still use your antenna tuner in the 50 ohm input, 50 ohm output mode, because it is another tuned stage, which is the equivalent of a low pass filter or a band pass filter, giving you harmonic suppression. And you didn't say it, but I'll bet you the main reason why Collins emphasized heavy loading is that most amplifiers with heavy loading give you the greatest linearity. The quickest way to get non-linearity is light loading, which automatically gives you flat topping. Flat topping comes from the fact that the tube is lightly loaded, you're driving it heavily. During the peak of modulation, you're bottoming out the voltage on the plate circuit, and the plate circuit can't go below I'll pick a number, 200 volts. Below that, the plate won't draw enough current compared to the control grid or the screen grid if you had one. And as such, any further drive doesn't give you any more output. That's what really gives you flat topping, light loading and heavy drive. As long as you've got heavy loading, you get greater linearity. And when you back off on the drive, as far as the tube is concerned, the voltage swing on the plate decreases. Therefore, the tube thinks it's heavier on its loading, therefore the tube gives you greater linearity. So for a whole bunch of reasons, I wouldn't worry about changing the inductor, because you've got a great big heavy copper coil in there right now, which I think is not running very hot. What little heat you get, I think, is from the current flowing through your band switch, and that's where the greatest number of ohms, milliohms of resistance is in your band switch. And as long as it's taking it, I wouldn't worry about changing the inductor. I wouldn't worry about reloading. I would just back off on the drive, and for two or three different reasons, I think Mel and I are coming to the same conclusion. What if it all makes some sense, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW.
Yeah,
K2RIW,
N2EO. What you say makes a lot of sense. The only thing that's a little problem here, if I go to a tri-band Yagi and load up, I first have to load up full power back to drive off. If I load up into the antenna and not a dummy load, I'm going to fly those tracks. Between the time I load up and back off the power. So there are two answers here. One, load up into a dummy load, back the power off, switch to the antenna, or to load up and have power on the drive and just adjust the loading to maximum output in half drive.
I'll give another comment on that.
Yeah, there's another approach, Rich. You can load up into your antenna with full power, full voltage, full drive by sending a series of dots. Set your automatic gear to only be on the air 50% of the time, sending dots. Your average power will be half of your normal power. You won't burn up the antenna, but yet as long as you've got a properly operating power output indicator, you can still tune up for maximum power. That's one approach. Let's see what Mel's got to say. You got it, Mel.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that approach. I've got something that does that now.
Fantastic. Mel, what was your idea on this one?
Okay, Roger. Let me tell you, I have a TA-36 Mosley, a big tri-bander. In fact, this one is bigger because they came up with a modification some years ago, which I got involved with. I think it was more nonsense than anything else, but putting a bigger boom on it. And I have loaded that thing up to plenty of power, you know, and nothing happened to the traps on it. Nothing at all. The traps that they have on that Mosley tri-banded, you are not going to fry those traps, believe me. So don't worry about that. Now, as far as, like you said, with the tuner and all, it goes a long way, that tuner, to have that in your line. I have told this to a number of people, and they gave me cross-eyed looks. I said, this can go a long way to solving your TVI problem, putting the tuner in. Yeah, but I have this low SF, I just put the tuner in. And then I got some feedback a number of times that, yeah, you were right. That proper tuning of the amplifier, and then with the tuner on it, and it does a lot to attenuate problems like TVI, Dick, over.
Boy, do I believe that, because that tuner is really another bandpass filter. If your tank circuit is giving you 25 dB of rejection of harmonics, and your antenna tuner is running similar Q, it's giving you another 25 dB, making a total of 50 dB of attenuation. In my numeric example, just to prove the principle. And depending on how you adjust the tuning and loading controls on the antenna tuner, you can make it reject the harmonics even more by setting it for the higher C to L ratio. Lower the inductor, raise the capacitor until you hit resonance again. You'll have a little bit more dissipation in the tuner, but if you've got a rugged enough tuner, it can take it, and it'll give you maybe better performance than a commercially made low-pass filter. The number of low-pass filters you can buy that can take a kilowatt or two is not too many. Another thing you can realize here, Rich, and that is, even if your antenna cannot take key-down power at your power level continuously without burning up its traps, still, depending on the amount of mass of metal in those traps, they have a certain thermal time constant. Maybe that thermal time constant is 10 seconds. If you do tune-up by 3 seconds on, 3 seconds off, 3 seconds on, you're running an average of half power as far as the thermal time constant of that trap is concerned. So that's another way you can do it, by way of the automatic dot sender or by doing it in brief bursts. There's lots of ways you can do it. N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet. KC2NJY.
Okay, Dick, bring you down here to the station in 2EO. Very good, Dick. Well, see, that was one of my reasons for not wanting to go with a trap antenna, but if I read Mel correctly, he's say it can take more than Mosley says it can. So, alright, very good. Anyway, the roof tower will be going up in a few weeks. I guess the rotator here, part is over at Solar's house, is going to do the installation. And probably by the end of February we'll have it up, and then making the final decision to see when the antenna goes up. What I like about the quad is no traps, high performance. You know, the 2-element quad is like a 3-element tri-bander, or a 3-element mono-bander actually. But, you know, the other side of the coin is to go with the track antenna, a little lower performance, but less maintenance, because I can't go up there myself. Back to you, Ben, K2RIW, and 2EO.
Very fine, Eric. I'm going to pick you up in a second. This was TechNet number 1172, and we are proving that there are people who don't think the universe revolves around Arizona's Super Bowl football game. There are some people who don't watch that particular game. You're hearing them here tonight. Mel and I are proving it. Eric, KC2NJY, what would you like to add?
KC2CDL is here.
And Andy, recognized. K2RIW here, Eric. My name is Dick. You've got it, Eric. KC2NJY, did I hear you incorrectly? Okay, maybe he got called away. Andy, you got the floor. And how's your experiments going?
All right, I just finished watching the game, and the Giants won. Just want to mention that. So we're going to have a nice parade in the city. It was an unbelievable game. Very close score, too. Okay. And, so Dick, I just wanted to apologize. The link is down. You probably heard it time out by saying a COS Logitech. So that's going to be worked on. That's it. I was watching the games. I really wasn't paying attention over here. But it's a once-in-a-lifetime thing, so we did that. But right now, I got to get ready for work tomorrow, so I wanted to tell you that, Dick, and everybody else. Back to you.
Good news, Andy. As you know, New York was by far not favored. The other team was supposedly undefeated, essentially. And the fact that New York won, my goodness, is there going to be a celebration. Guaranteed it's going to be a victory parade down Fifth Avenue. And Andy, those subways are going to be filled up with people. It's going to be like New Year's Eve. What do you think, Andy?
Probably worse. Yeah, you're right about that. And the score was 17-14, by the way. Would you believe it? And they could have been in field goal range, but Eli Manning was really magnificent. He was great. Okay, not to get into all that stuff, but they did a good job. 17-14 Giants. All right. So that's about it. I don't know who the valuable player is. Because I turned it off. Most valuable player. It could be Manning himself because he kept his cool. And there was one unbelievable play where he was able to get away from four tacklers all around him, and I don't know how he did it. He just squirted out of there and made a terrific pass somehow. It's just really something. All right, anyway, that's it. I'll let you go. I'm going to go with that WCDL. I'll talk to you next week.
My brother down in Florida is big on football. Guarantee he was bidding for the Patriots. Too bad I didn't have a bet with him. I would have had some fun with it, but I know so little about football. when it comes to the scarring, it's all mysterious to me. And I have heard some of the people predicting ahead of time that if they managed to squeak by, the score would be 17 to 14. I've heard people predict that. If they manage to squeak by, it's going to be a low score and very close. And some of those predictions came out very well. Okay, we're going to be hearing about this for a long time to come. What's your guess? Has anyone mentioned when the victory parade is going to take place? Do you think it's going to be Monday afternoon? What's your guess, Andy?
I believe Tuesday is what they plan.
Okay. And I think I've heard tell that the mayor and various people in New York City were planning on a huge celebration. They just thought that there's only about a 20% chance or whatever that you get a chance to use it. Now they're going to get a chance to use those plans. Alrighty. Boy, all that equipment in the subway better really be humming. It's going to be busy. Bye-bye. Anybody else want to add any comments to all of the above? Give me a call with us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay. I think we've gone down our list of questioners, Mel. I suspect you've got your usual 75 emails in your mailbag. And so, are there any good ones there that you think we should review tonight?
PNJ.
Okay, Mr. PNJ. We called you earlier, Bob, and we saved a place for you. You got the floor, Bob. You're number one on the runway right now.
Yeah, my wife's a big football fan. She called me. She said, you got to see it. Just an update. A while back, I was telling you I had a problem with my carbon monoxide multi-sector combination unit going off when I was using the amplifier. I tried a number of things. The ferrite didn't work. Multiple ferrites on the Romex or whatever didn't work. So that unit that I had was made by KID, K-I-D-E-E. I went and replaced it with a BRK unit, BRK. And it's been working fine. Just want to pass that on to anybody. And it wasn't the smoke that was going up, it was the carbon monoxide portion of the unit that was being triggered. But this unit, the BRK, is immune to the RS. Just want to pass that on to you, man. W2PSA.
Sounds like a beautiful solution. Roughly, what's the price of the BRK, Bob?
I picked it up at NNS on Jericho Turnpike in Huntington. I believe it's about $56.
Very nice price. Can you imagine somebody hearing the name of that particular electrical supply house in Huntington over the telephone for the first time and trying to figure out what in the world the operator is saying? Ain't that a crazy name for a company?
Yeah, I guess you got to use the phonetics for it.
Yeah, but the average person doesn't know what the hell phonetics means. So the first time they hear it on the phone, if they didn't look it up in the phone book where they see it in writing, it would be very difficult to figure out what the hell the operator is saying. Okay, it's good. That's a good electrical supply house, though. They got some pretty good equipment. My guess is you can find things in there that you might not find in Lowe's or Home Depot. What do you think, Bob?
Well, the problem I had was I went to Schwing Electric over in Amityville in Farmingdale, and they only handled the KID unit. AC was the same thing, and NNS was the only one that had BRK. But let me go try it, and sure enough, it's been working fine.
What gave you the idea to go to BRK, to change brand name? What gave you the idea that the brand name was sensitive and that changing brand name could fix it? You hit the nail on the head, but how did you know that?
Tell you the truth, I didn't. I wanted to try another brand, and because I know I could always reuse this unit somewhere else, but not in my house, that's for sure. And I know that, I said, you know, what do I got to lose? If it don't work, I'll bring it back, so, you know, because it doesn't get damaged. But that's what I did, and it worked.
Alrighty. The question I had for you earlier, which I may have already gotten an answer from you, but I'm going to double check. I've decided to add a second fuse box, or a circuit breaker box, alongside of my main one. So I've got cascaded circuit breakers. And of the cable that goes from the first breaker fuse panel over to the second one, it is a four-wire cable containing your red, black, white, and ground. And the way I adjusted it is to make sure that the ground of the first box is connected to the ground of the second box. On the first box, which is the main drop for the house, in that one place, the neutral and the grounds are connected together. From then on downrange into the second fuse box and any of the circuit breakers downrange, I carried the neutrals as a floating neutral, but only the ground wire between the boxes is grounding the box. I think I've done it correctly when I did that. The one thing that worries me is that the piece of wire going from the first fuse box to the second fuse box is not in a piece of conduit, but it is a four-wire lead. In your opinion, is that up to code, Bob? W2PNJ, KQRIW.
Yeah, you're good. As long as, like you said, your main fuse box, which is your service panel, your neutral and grounds are tied together, which is bonded to the cabinet, and your sub-panel, the one downstream, has separate neutrals and grounds, and as you said, your neutral bar is floating. It's isolated from ground. So all your feed is coming in to feeding in the circuit. You have separate place for your neutral, the white wire, and a separate place for your ground wire, which goes to a ground bus, which is bonded to the cabinet. And make sure you don't have your, that's right, your neutral bar, you said it was floating. Yeah, that's fine.
And the fact that the ground wire between the two is a slightly lighter gauge than the conductors, is that still up to code?
What do you have? What's feeding the sub-panel? Is that coming off a two-pole breaker or two fuses?
That's correct. I do have cascaded fuses. I've got a 220 circuit that I know is lightly loaded, so I'm using it cascaded. The output is going to a light load and also the auxiliary fuse box, circuit breaker downrange. And the wiring between the boxes is 8-gauge, and the neutral, of course, is 8-gauge, but I think the ground wire is either 10 or 12-gauge. It's a lighter conductor for ground, and to your opinion, is that still code? I know it will be a little bit safer if that auxiliary box is being fed by a piece of conduit. That would give you a little bit more fire protection if something should go wrong. Back to you, Bob.
Let me check the code book. I'll get right back to you.
Very good. Was there someone else who had a comment on this one? Okay. Take your time on that one, Bob. While Bob's coming back, Mel, do you think you've got a mail that's worth reading? It's your choice. Here we go. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is KQKEY. Oh boy, did I have a session this past week on 75 meters with that receiving unit. And because I had made a comment, and there were a number of people who were listening, that I was getting good copy, and everybody was complaining about the noise level, 5.9 plus, and I, what's your noise level? And I said, sound like S3 and 4. How do you account for that? I said, well, it's on my regular loop. I try to explain and went through the whole deal again, the whole spiel, as they say, and receiving loops, and I've had emails on it, and I've been describing it, telling where to look for it and all, and unbelievable. Oh, before I forget, one guy, 1:30 Wednesday night in the morning, 1:30 in the morning, I had just finished up with the crew, and I was just about ready to shut down, and a station called me and says, I haven't spoken to you in maybe 50 years. I said, oh, really? And he was a teenager with me here in Brooklyn, and we had met on the air back when he was novice. I had already been a general, but I had worked him on CW here in Brooklyn, and he's always here, you know, I hear a strong station get on here, and so we come back to them, and I'll see who's new around the area. And we started talking about this and that, what we did with our lives and everything. And he now lives in Silver Spring, Maryland. And he said the last job he had in New York before he left was he was an engineer for AIL, Dick, and he knows you extremely well, over.
PNJ?
Okay, yeah. It's going to be fun to discuss this one. Well, let's pick up with Bob with the previous subject. Go ahead, Bob. Am I up to code, or do I have to change things in a hurry?
Dick, what size is the two-pole breaker feeding the sub-panel?
The two-pole breaking the sub, feeding the sub-panel, let me think now. I think it's a 40 ampere, go ahead.
Number 10 ground wire would be fine, that's the minimum size.
Okay, so in other words, I think I see what's going on here. Whatever the maximum current of the circuit breaker is, the neutral certainly has got to be able to take that with some safety, and I think you're saying the ground wire has got to be able to take the circuit breaker current. Is that true?
Yeah, you could. It's article table number 250-95.
Okay, that's good to know. And so the fact that that piece of cable is not in conduit is not necessarily a problem, although I presume it would be better if it was in conduit for two reasons. One, it would give it more fire protection, and number two, the conduit itself would be providing an auxiliary ground. Back to you, Bob.
That's correct. As long as you have it protected from mechanical damage, because any wire less than smaller than a six has to be mechanically protected. Many times we do 100 amp service, we'll use the number six ground wire because we can nail that directly to studs, to beams, without any mechanical protection on it. Technically, the book says that you can use the number eight for 100 amp service, but that has to be mechanically protected. If you look on these old services, you'll see a number eight inside of a miniature DX type of jacket on it. But that's not available anymore. So we use six, which is good for 150 amps, because that can be secured directly without a mechanical protection on it.
Now, if I had decided to take the main input line and parallel it directly through that piece of wire you and I are discussing, the four-leaded wire, red, black, white, plus ground, and if that went into the auxiliary circuit breaker, but was wired directly from the line, not through the series set of fuses or a circuit breaker I've got now, the 40 amp circuit breaker, my guess is I would not be code doing that. Is that true?
Number one, the ground wire would then have to be a minimum of a number eight, but the bigger problem is you have too many disconnects to shut the entire service down. That's where your code violation would be. Years ago, they would allow a maximum of six disconnects to shut the entire residential service off, but I think you know your maximum allowable now is only two.
Yeah, in my case, if I had done that, I would be four circuit breakers. The auxiliary box has got two circuit breakers, and the main box, the drop panel, whatever you want to call it, to disconnect the whole house there is also two circuit breakers. So I've got a total of four. You're saying everything's got to be two to be code. What is that, since roughly 1990 or so?
Correct.
Okay. Now I know where I stand. And I thank you, Bob. You can mail me an invoice for the consulting fee. Okay. Now, who in the world, 50 years ago, you used to go to school with, he worked for a whole lot of years at AIL. Oh, I can think of one guy that fulfills that requirement. Joe Sincotta. Is that the name?
Oh, this is KUKEY. He didn't go to high school with me, but we went to college together. Briefly. We only say that it's funny, you know, that we had a parallel situation. He's basically a year younger than us. But had a parallel situation that when he graduated high school, he graduated Yeshiva High School. He says financially, he says, was tight. So he also enrolled like I did for the first couple of years of taking the required pre-engineering courses that you could pick up in Brooklyn College at night. He did the same thing, and I said, yes. And then he went on, later on, he got himself a BS and then a master's degree. His name is J-A-Y, and his call is K2P, like a Peter, B like a Bravo, F like in Sierra. Do you know him, over?
K2PBS, Papa Bravo Sierra, is that true?
Right, that's it. That's his original call here. And probably also started out as KN2PBS. And when he mentioned AIL, of course, you came to mind, and I said, did you ever work with Dick Canato at K2RIW? He says, sure. He says, I remember Dick quite well. I was in radar, he says. So I used to run into Dick quite often. He says he was in the radar division, over.
Okay. Jacob Harness. P-A-R-N-E-S-S. Jacob Parnas, now in Silver Spring, Maryland. I don't think I know Jacob very well. Because he was in the radar division, and because for most of the years of AIL's history, radar was in the Melville plant, and I worked in the Deer Park plant, the big house. He worked in the Melville plant, which we called the clubhouse. He may have seen my name a whole lot of times in the company newspaper, the so-called AIL record, but I don't think I ever worked directly with Jacob. I'm having a little bit of trouble placing him. It could be one of those situations where he knows me, but I don't know him very well. Mel, go ahead.
According to him, because he saw you regularly, that you had regular conversations with him and all. So he knew right offhand. He says, is Dick still that good-looking, thin, tall guy with the light color, the blonde hair? I says, well, kind of. I says, we're a little older now. He says, I remember him as being a real good-looking fellow, over.
And now he's exaggerating. Jacob was born 1941, so he's a year younger than me. I've never had blonde hair. Oh, sometimes in the summertime in my youth, with a whole lot of sun exposure, my hair got a little bit light-colored. And the first few years I worked there, yeah, I was a little bit on the light side, 165 pounds. But for the last 20 or so years, I've gained some weight. My hair got darker, what little hair there is. So he's describing a memory of a guy that no longer exists, Mel. What's your guess as to what year Jacob retired from AIL, if you happen to know?
I think he said he stayed there until they chased all you guys out. What year was that, Dick, over?
Well, there was more than one buyout series, but the main one, the biggest buyout, occurred in January 31st, 2000. That was the biggest buyout where they thought they were getting rid of 20 people, and 51 or 52 people took the deal. So the biggest buyout that I ever remember was January 31, 2000. But that was only 7 years ago. And that's the right time. He could have been part of the group. I have to go back to my records and see if he was part of those 51 or 52 people. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm not sure. He said he was so happy to hear that, you know, he's still active and all that kind of stuff. He said he had a lot of nice talks with you, I guess, maybe about ham radio or whatever in the past. And we were on the air just like after 2 in the morning, just reminiscing and all. And he works now for the government there and lives in Maryland. And is a government employee working on some hush-hush stuff because I can't really discuss the details. And that's it. So he was quite amazed to hear your name mentioned. And, well, he just happened to come across the frequency, and he heard my call letters, and he says, I'll never forget those call letters. He says, what you doing with yourself, Mel, in the last 50 years? So you can well imagine that we went on and on and on to the wee hours of the morning, Dick, over.
Yeah, with the call letters of PBS, which probably was an original issue, it sounds like he got his license, what, around us? K-L-M-N-O-P-Q-R. You got yours, I think, in 70, correction, 54. I got mine in 56. I'm guessing he was licensed at 55, age 14, is when he was first licensed in Brooklyn. Sure, I guess on my part, but ballpark figure. Silver Spring, Maryland. He could very well work for NRL, Naval Research Laboratory. What do you think?
Yeah, very possible. They got a number of those labs that are affiliated with a number of the government's so-called, you know, agencies, secret agencies and whatnot in that area. I can tell you another one, of course, is that there's, you know, in the area there, a super secret operation. So it could be any of those. But anyhow, he was so happy to hear that you're around, and he asked, you get on 75. I said, well, he's not on 75. He's still working mostly on microwaves and all. So, he says, oh, too bad. He says, I'd love to talk to him. Boy, he says, I'd love to have another QSO with Dick. It's all right. it's just that it was so surprising, you know, so many things that we have in common. And I have not spoken to him, oh, the last time, at least around 50 years ago, Dick. We just you know, lost contact right after, you know, high school and the college and the things. Everybody went their separate ways. So it was just, you know, nice to really reminisce about the good old days of our teenage years in the 50s, Dick. Life is short, sort of, I could say, changed over.
What's your best guess, Mel? Do you think Jacob has ever been a VHFer, or do you think he's been a pure HFer all of his life? And if he was a pure HFer, and I'm almost a pure VHFer, got an extra class license, but below 30 megacycles, I think I've used it, you know, 1 hour in the last 20 years. So if he's a pure HFer, that's part of the reason you and I have not run into him all this time. How about you, Mel?
Well, he operates, from what I understand, the equipment it has and all. He does a lot of operating on whatever comes along. He's very active. I asked him, I said, you can still consider an active ham? He says, yeah, I'm really active. I enjoy it. He says, that's the way I relax with this and operate, gets on CW and all. So I would assume that, you know, he's like me here and there all over whatever spare time. You know, like I say, I use it purely every night if I get on CW. To me, it's my sleeping pill. I fall asleep many times listening to, just monitoring CW. Last night I was very interested. I got on about 12:30 at night and basically came home late, but I knew I had to settle down. So I got on CW, 40 CW. It's a bit on the great side from what it's been. I mean, it really was pretty good last night. And it was a heck of a lot of pile up on the FJ. Fox Juliet, that's the new entity in the FCC, St. Bartholomew Island down there in the Caribbean. So it was a bit of, so after I worked them, I was listening to their calls. I wanted, you know, specifically the noise level was low at that time at night to speak of, and I was specifically always trying to listen to the weak signals. I wanted to see where they are, and I was even able to hear a number of the JAs calling them. And those are, of course, the big guns. I recognize the calls of the JAs that were getting through to this part of the world, which is a bit of a problem with the propagation we've been going through. And I heard a number of the others, but I know the ones with the big antennas shows you. The ones with those big antennas and everything in the great location seem to always be able to do something that you don't expect, Dick. I can hear them, but I can never work those stations, some of those JAs and all that I hear that are working some of the DX stations. So they are the few that are there with some very, very big antenna arrays, like we've seen. They all seem to be able to manage some big, like, beams for 40 meters even, somewhere in the 5 and 6 elements for 40 meters on towers. How do they get these things together? I don't even know. I can't even conceive building such a thing, but I guess if you have the money, you can do anything over.
Can you imagine having something like a 100-foot long boom on top of your house and rotating it where the boom might, the elements of the boom might extend over the neighbor's property? Unless you've got extremely friendly neighbors, that would be an interesting requirement there. I am guessing that Jacob was not very much on 2 meters or 432 sideband. Otherwise, I would have talked to him a lot earlier than this. But the whole reason you got on to Jacob in the first place is because you got into your usual controversy where you're describing what your tiny little loop can do. And, of course, everybody listening saying, hey, this guy is crazy. He's testing our gullibility, and he's giving us this tall tale. Because such a high percentage of reasonable ham radio operators do not believe that story. I think ultimately, Mel, whenever you think you're through with that experiment, you're going to have to write it up and make sure that QST does not publish it on the April 1st issue. Otherwise, people will say, uh-huh, that's the nut paper for that issue. Make sure it's not the April issue that it's published, but I think ultimately you're going to have to publish it because until it's in writing with enough information to give it authority and traceability to the Bureau, you're going to continuously be hit with people who say it can't possibly be true. I was in a conference call to a very smart antenna person in the Boston area Thursday afternoon, in which we got on the subject of what gain you can get out of a fraction of a wavelength dipole or a fraction of a wavelength loop. And boy, was I getting flack. And so it is a whole subject that has been highly misunderstood by ordinarily intelligent people. More has to be written on the subject. That combined with Faraday rotation and what it's doing to HF propagation and what looks like selective fading. My goodness, are those misunderstood subjects. One of these days, you're going to have to put pen to paper on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Right, this is K2KEY. In fact, I got a schedule tomorrow night, 11:30, which I promised to keep with a station in Pennsylvania that joined us, and he got so interested, so excited about it. That was the guy I was on with him to 1:30 in the morning. From 11:30 at night to 1:30 in the morning, he went back and forth. I emailed him a whole bunch of information where some of the details on the loop can be found if he had heard, of course, of, you know, the full-wave transmitting loops. And surely they've done enough articles on, you know, like the loop I'm using, the 272 feet of loop. But when I mentioned that I have this in the shack and I turn it, I know, then I built the second one that fits inside the first one that half the size, and how I went about putting it in through the QRN squasher and the Q multiplier system and everything. He was, he says, I can't believe all this. He says, you're telling me that you have better results with that than that loop that you're transmitting on? I says, yes. He says, well, the transmitting loop is sure putting in a heck of a signal here. He says, you're usually consistently, I hear you all the time, one of the stronger ones on the band. And I said, well, I am not looking for, you know, DX basically with this, but I'm looking for good coverage of the tri-state area where all my friends are located, basically. And he says, well, you sure do put that signal, because he says, many a times, he says, when the other signals are down, really almost at noise level and all, he says, you're always at least a few dB above it. So he says, you must be doing something right. No, he went on and on and on. So I'm going to get together with him tomorrow night. Yeah, it's putting it together in a, you know, an article that makes sense and all, and organizing. All right, sometimes, Dick, if you want to go together, we sit down, you know, maybe like a field day or something, we get together and all, we'll get into a little further, you know, discussion. I got a lot of paperwork on it and everything. Maybe if you kind enough to want to go half-piece on this, we can put together a very interesting article. I can say very misunderstood a lot of this with Doppler and with propagation and rotation, Faraday rotation, all this kind of stuff that would have to be maybe in a series of articles. All right, well, okay, where was I? Anyhow, that's basically where it stands at this point. It's hard, like I say, you know, I was listening last night to weak stations of 40 meters, it's amazing that these people, like you say, with these beams, how they even build them, putting on a roof, you know, you get to talk with most, how you tear the roof up, and twist around and turn the house around. But they're doing it. One guy, like I said, my friend Woody, there in New Hampshire, he managed to get a three-element beam up on a 187-foot tower for 80 meters. You know, a three-element 80-meter beam. That's a big antenna. It's a lot of weight, a lot of reinforcing, you know, materials required to keep those elements from being torn apart by wind or droopings and everything. And to get it up on top of a 187-foot tower, guy, you know, and he's on top of a mountain that's 600 feet tall in New Hampshire. So, you know, it's mind-boggling, but it doesn't seem to be, you know, only ones around. I can tell you a couple of them, Dick, over.
Yep. I'd like to know the call letters of the guy in New Hampshire. There's a slim chance I know who it is. But now, here's the general question I got for you, Mel, and I'm only looking for an approximate answer. On the average night, in the receiver mode, when you compare your 272-foot loop to the small loop in the shack with you that has been properly tuned in AS, L, and polarization, on average, how much better is the signal-to-noise ratio in decibels of the small loop compared to the big loop? On average, how many dB better? Back to you, Mel.
I'll tell you, it is considerable. Let's take the other night. Friday night. Friday night conditions were exceptionally noisy on 75 feet. On my regular full 272 feet of loop antenna, the noise level was varying between F on the meter, on the Collins meter. I mean, I can't go by it. I have to try to plan to make this at the F unit, because remember, Collins is strictly in dB. It's a highly calibrated meter in dB. So, let me translate it over. Let's say it would be F7 to F8. F7 times 42. About F7 to F8 in noise level with the outside receiving loop regulator. Let's say now if I use the receiving loop and null the noise down and all, around F3. If you want to, let's see how many dBs. I got to translate this all of the dBs so everybody will understand. Let's say difference of at least 4 dBs. No, 4 F units. 4 F units difference at a minimum, Dick. Sometimes 5 F units over.
Okay, 4 S units is 24 decibels of difference. If it's 6 dB per S unit on a well-calibrated meter. If that's the noise difference, is there any difference in signal level? If the signal came out the same, then it would be at 4 decibel advantage. Even if the signal was a whole S unit weaker on the small loop, that still would be 18 dB of difference improvement for the small. So roughly, what's the difference in signal level on big loop versus small loop when it's all tuned up just right? Back to you, Mel.
I just vary now. With conditions, there are times that the signal level on the big loop, the 272 feet of loop, the signal level is higher on that. There are times. But most of the time, I will say most of the time, that the signal level is the same. Believe it or not, this is what is so hard when I tell you the truth. I hesitate to say these things that it's either usually the same or somewhat better on the receiving loop. they question, how did you get a big loop? But I keep, when I say it's less than 0.1 wavelength, and they say, they don't hear the 0.1. Oh, a one wavelength loop that you can rotate. No. 0.1 wavelength. Not possible. That's it. I've had this guy come on frequency, never give their call letters and say, what are you, making some, let me tell you some of the things on 75 meters. No wonder they don't give their calls, because it gets a little colorful at time on 75 meters. Use your imagination. And sometimes it's a little too colorful. It gets a little bit of a free-for-all sometimes on 75 meters. They'll just pass by the frequency, have to listen, and they say, make a very obscene gesture verbally, to say the least, Dick. But I will say most of the time is compatible signal strength, or even at times maybe slightly better, but never really a drastic difference over.
Fantastic. Okay. When you say a tenth of a wavelength on the loop, are you speaking of diameter or circumference? And it almost doesn't matter which it is. In either case, it is very small compared to a resonant dimension. Therefore, you're establishing resonance by way of the tuning capacitor on the tips of that wire. and I'm not even talking about the impedance smashing you're doing and the Q multiplying and the noise slicing and so on. So the tenth of a wavelength, out of curiosity, is that circumference or diameter? Mel, go ahead.
Circumference. Basically, what I've got is a piece of RG8U coax. That's what made a frame. The big loop is 12 feet in circumference. It's a square, actually. It's a square. It's a diamond standing up on end. If you want to look at a base, if you're looking at a baseball diamond, you know, the home plate is where the variable capacitor and the two ends of the coax, of course, terminate. And then I made the frame. I thought it was wooden. It was in home deep cold, some molding. It's square molding, 3/4 inch wide by 1/4 inch thick. And I just tacked the corners together, glued it with some Elmer's glue, so it stiffened it up. And then tacked the coax around the outer periphery of the 12 feet of coax. Put the shield, of course, up at the top of the second base. And then, you know, I could say the variable condenser would be at the home plate. That's basically the big one. The second one, which I actually is my noise sensor loop, that one is 3 feet, half the size. And now they all fall into the category of being within less than 0.1 wavelength, Dick. And this is when you say an antenna 0.1 wavelength, you know, it's mind-boggling, I guess, when you hear it first time, because you know what you're envisioning, that how the heck did you make a thing like that under any circumstances resonate, but it's let's put it this way, the first time I did it, I was sat there flabbing. I put the AEA antenna around.
You're getting a little...
Sorry. Just slipped out of my hand. That when I put the AEA analyzer on the first time and I saw it, I was able to resonate that right on the frequency. I was flabbergasted, Dick, also how well it did resonate over.
Fantastic. Now, here's my question. Your full wave loop outside, 272 feet circumference, a tenth of that wavelength would be 27.2 feet. Your coax cable is 12 feet. Your circumference, if it's 12 feet, is 0.05 wavelength, not even 0.1. And that 12 feet of coax, is that one turn or multiple turns in the way you've got it stacked on that wooden frame? Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, it's one turn. Well, the specification on the formulation when you want to design is that the prescription is that you do not exceed 0.1 wavelength. So everything on this system, I can say, stays below its less than one wavelength, 0.1 wavelength. That's the, in other words, your cutoff, they tell you, for receiving loop with the formulas that they gave in. They give you, you know, the basic system that was laid out, if you want to read into it, you know, he built that 160, you saw it in the magazine there in the manual, with his wife standing there, he's got that 160 loop. That is double the size. That is approximately what did he go for? 6 feet on each side of the square. And the way he laid out the formulation, if you want to, you know, duplicate anything. In other words, the constriction is that you do not exceed 0.1 wavelength. So yes. So in this case here, it's one turn. It's 12 feet of coax cable that flips around approximately around the edge of the frame, over.
Okay. That implies that your frame is, if it's square, roughly 3 feet on the side. And the only reason why they're telling you to make it a tenth of a wavelength or less is so that the current around the loop is nearly constant. Therefore, if the loop was laying parallel to the ground, it would be a horizontally polarized antenna, and it would be omnidirectional. If your loop is parallel to the ground, it would be a horizontally polarized antenna. As the loop gets longer, it starts developing a more and more dipole pattern.